I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Bill Moyers in defense of public broadcasting. The founding principles of public broadcasting urged that programming serve as a forum for debate and controversy and provide a voice for groups that may otherwise be unheard. Ever since its inception, public broadcasting in the United States has been a lightning rod for political attack. A heat shield funding proposal to insulate PBS and NPR from congressional whims was defeated. The Nixon administration was the first to launch the canard that the system was biased in favor of liberals. Note that the longest-running public affairs program on PBS was iconic conservative William F. Buckley's Firing Line. The Corporation for Public Broadcasting, CPB, partially funds public TV and radio. In mid-July, Congress, by razor-thin margins, voted to eliminate previously approved funding for CPB. This action will negatively impact hundreds of public TV and radio stations. Staff will be laid off. Programs will be discontinued.
In Idaho, a teacher was recently forced to take down a poster in her classroom that said, "Everyone is welcome here." They said that was a divisive political statement. And you know what? From the fascist point of view, that is a divisive political statement, because their goal is to ensure that everybody is not welcome in this country. And it starts with this war in the classroom to teach kids that this is the new reality.
That's Jesse Hagopian, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Jesse Hagopian on the war on education. The right-wing war on education is well documented. The battleground extends from elementary and middle school all the way up to Harvard and Columbia. Books have been cut from curricula and pulled from school library shelves. Teachers have been fired. Schools that teach critical race theory and diversity, equity, and inclusion are being threatened with defunding. The radical right wants to control what is being taught. They want to turn the educational system into an indoctrination machine. Their goal includes plans to abolish the Department of Education. Students who peacefully protest and exercise their First Amendment rights have been, in some cases, suspended, expelled, and even denied their diplomas. Some international students have had their visas canceled and may face deportation. Jesse Hagopian says what's at stake is the freedom to expose injustice and to tell the truth. Our guest today is Jesse Hagopian. He's a Seattle-based educator who has taught in public schools for over 20 years. He's the director of the Zen Education Project's Teaching for Black Lives campaign. He is an editor of Rethinking Schools and the author of Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education. He spoke at Socialism 2025 in Chicago in July. And now, Jesse Hagopian.
There is a war going on right now to eradicate ways of knowing that challenge power. And my book talks about this war, but it's not just about the repression, it's also about the resistance, both the brave resistance happening right now and the long legacy of the fight for black education and liberatory ways of knowing. You know, I just want to stress that because education at its best isn't just preparation for work under capitalism, it's preparation for freedom. We fight for schools that don't just sort and rank children, but help them build solidarity, that don't just serve a capitalist economy, but serve meeting human needs. And don't just enrich a few wealthy parasites, but actually expand our sense of belonging, our imagination, and help us build a world where nobody is disposable. And so I offer this talk today, not just as political strategy for how to fight back against billionaires and white supremacists, but also as a fulfillment of my promise to my ancestors that I wouldn't lie about their experience and that I would share it with everyone that I could. The laws today are becoming so over the top. They're just so absurd. These laws that are being passed to regulate what we can think about, that really only the Onion can fully capture the situation. Did people see the Onion headline from a couple years ago? There's a photo of a black teacher at the head of the class. And it says, "Teacher fired for breaking state's critical race theory law after telling students she's black." And then Seattle has a version of the Onion that might be even better. You guys read the Needling. The Needling had a picture of Governor Ron DeSantis from Florida, and the headline said, "Florida bans the letters LGBTQ from the alphabet." Right, and then the whole article is like quotes from Florida officials that leave out those letters. Never did much reading, right? But you know, the satire is barely distinguishable from the reality. I mean, the reality is more absurd than that. You have to think about what Florida is actually doing. Right now, the official state curriculum in Florida says that slavery is of, quote, personal benefit to black people. This is not in the Ku Klux Klan's youth handbook. This is in the official state curriculum. In Florida, they banned the AP African American Studies. We know that. But do people know that it's a felony if you get caught with a banned book in your classroom? It's a 5-year jail sentence with a $5,000 fine. They went so far as to banning the dictionary in one Florida school district because, after all, it does have the word transgender in it. It does have the word sex and racism. When I say that the reality is more absurd than the Onion can come up with, this is what I'm talking about. In Idaho, a teacher was recently forced to take down a poster in her classroom that said, "Everyone is welcome here." They said that was a divisive political statement. And you know what? From the fascist point of view, that is a divisive political statement because their goal is to ensure that everybody is not welcome in this country. And it starts with this war in the classroom to teach kids that this is the new reality. Across the country, kids have been banned from learning about the Tulsa Massacre, Japanese American incarceration during World War II. A study in the Washington Post back in 2022 showed that over 160 educators across the country had been fired or pushed out of their classroom for teaching about race, gender, or sexuality. And we know that number was low then, and it certainly has increased by a lot now. And we're talking about people like Amy Donofrio in Florida, who taught at Robert E. Lee High School. A high school named after a genocidal maniac who murdered more people than any war, than all the wars in U.S. history combined. A school named after a genocidal white supremacist, and she put up a sign in her classroom that said Black Lives Matter so that kids knew that in this hostile white supremacist space that this was a safe place for them. And she was fired for doing so and learned that she was fired by on the radio when she heard the governor say that they were going after her for her wokeness. You know, Matthew Hahn was fired in Tennessee for teaching an award-winning author, Ta-Nehisi Coates. You have James Whitfield, a black principal in Texas, who after George Floyd was murdered, sent out an email to his school community saying that systemic racism is alive and well. And he was pushed out. You have my friend Melissa Temple in Wisconsin, incredible educator, veteran teacher, former editor with Rethinking Schools, who's teaching first grade, and her kids wanted to sing a song called Rainbow Land for the school musical. Highly subversive song. Okay, we're talking about a pop song by Miley Cyrus and Dolly Parton here, okay? That doesn't even mention LGBTQ plus people, but does say we should live in a world where we're all treated equally. And she thought they had the right to sing that song, even though the principal banned it and the school district backed up that ban. And so on her own time, on a Friday after school at home, on her private Twitter account, she tweets out, "I think they should have the right to sing this song." And she showed up for school on Monday, and there was a head of HR in the school office and a police officer that escorted her out of the building, and she never got to see her children again, right? Those first graders, that relationship just severed. Fired, still no longer teaching. When we say fascism is rising in this country, we've been knowing it before Trump got elected, because if you're in the education field, you saw how this was working. I call these efforts to ban honest education, to ban books, I call them truth crime laws, because they criminalize honest education. And we are bearing witness to an era in which teachers who allow students to learn about racial disparities stemming from the legacy of slavery and Jim Crow segregation can be charged with a truth crime. And a truth crime is any act of honest pedagogy in a jurisdiction where truthful teaching has been outlawed. And truth crime is probably best described as enforced disremembering. A truth crime law, then, is one that makes lying to children obligatory and effectively renders honest education illegal. And the goal of the enforcers of truth crime, in the end, is to make committing a truth crime literally impossible, because there will be no one left to learn the honest history and therefore no one left to teach it. And this requires rewriting the past so that it appears to justify the dramatic inequality that exists today and impedes the ability of those who have learned the revisionist history to imagine a future without oppression. And so who are these people that are fighting to impose truth crime on our schools? I call them uncritical race theorists. In the cacophony of today's political discourse, debates about critical race theory are ubiquitous, but what's not discussed and what I believe must be studied is uncritical race theory. And uncritical race theory is the term I'm developing here to define systems of belief that unquestionably subscribe to status quo ideas about race and ideas that reinforce the existing racial power relations. So when we talk about uncritical race theory, we're talking about ideas that deny that racism exists at all, or ideas that claim it primarily victimizes white people or rejects any systemic or institutional analysis and instead reduces racism to sporadic individual explanations. And describing people who accept the status quo beliefs of race as uncritical race theorists, I think, is important because it helps us underscore that people opposing anti-racist education are not rejecting theory about race. You hear this a lot from the uncritical race theorists. They say, we don't want these radical teachers imposing their theories on our children. And they do that to try to label us as using unsubstantiated theories as if they didn't have a theory about race. They were the objective, neutral guardians of truth that have no theory about race. They just want to describe the world. But in fact, they have a highly developed theory of race. They just don't want their theory examined, because then we would see the origins of their theory lie in unsavory ideas like eugenics that have largely fallen out of favor. And so uncritical race theorists really demand an anodyne telling of American history, one that says that our country was delivered by the stork. And they'd rather not look into how the country was made, lest it offend delicate sensibilities. They tell themselves America doesn't fornicate, cuss, drink, brawl, abuse, exploit, lie, cheat, or steal. But as James Baldwin reminds us, people who shut their eyes to reality simply invite their own destruction. And anyone who insists on remaining in a state of innocence long after that innocence is dead turns himself into a monster. And let me give you some examples of uncritical race theory in action. We could start with Ted Cruz, who spoke at the Faith and Freedom Coalition not too long ago, and gripping the microphone, he bellowed, "Let me tell you right now that critical race theory is bigoted, it's a lie, and it's every bit as racist as the Klansmen in white sheets." I want us to sit with that for a second and just think about the argument he's making. He is saying that the teachers who want to teach about the KKK mass terrorist organization that killed thousands and lynched and maimed people are the same as the organization that actually did that murder and torture. Right? This is the level of intellectual sophistication we're dealing with here with these uncritical race theorists. Right? And it's not just right-wingers who are uncritical race theorists. We should be very clear that liberals are also uncritical race theorists. And I think that's why I think this term is useful, because we need to understand that there's a lot of overlap between liberals and conservatives when they analyze how race works in our society. Liberals tend to gravitate toward another tenet of uncritical race theory, which is the colorblind analysis, right? So when you remember when Obama got elected and everyone was screaming about the post-racial society we were living in, you had people like MSNBC hosts that were saying, I almost forgot Obama was black for the last hour while he was talking, right? The colorblind analysis from liberals have really opened the door to conservatives imposing even more openly hateful ideology. And, you know, in June 2024, we got another lesson in uncritical race theory from Trump, who was dismissed concerns about George Washington enslaving black people at the Faith and Freedom Coalition. He said, you know, they thought he had slaves. Actually, he probably didn't. Therein lies the essence of uncritical race theory, a calculated farce that prefers comforting delusions over the cotton-picking truth that George Washington owned 123 black people, adding 153 more through marriage to Martha. And, you know, Trump believes that the dishonesty to children about America's past is essential, because if students understand that this country was founded on the genocide of Native Americans and the enslavement of black people, they might begin to question our country, the foundations, the origins, and today's unequal distribution of resources and power. And as a teacher for the last 20 years, I've guided my students not only in assessing our nation through the eyes of George Washington, but also through the perspective of Ona Judge, who was an enslaved black woman who bravely escaped George Washington's forced labor camp. And I've always encouraged my students to think critically, to question everything, including me, including the sources that I'm bringing to them in the classroom, and refuse to exclude the role of race in U.S. history as part of their inquiry. That is what Black studies and ethnic studies and critical race theory and cultural studies and other traditions of resistance bring to education. And in the boundless satire that is the United States of America, we have a situation today where the oldest commemoration of the end of slavery, Juneteenth, became a federal holiday. At the same time, it became illegal to talk about where the holiday came from and why we needed it. And the land of the free just continues to take on new and intricate shades of mockery as more and more educators are fired or pushed out. And we're seeing one of the sharpest edges of this attack being inflicted on LGBTQ plus students, especially trans students right now, in a practice I call in the book educational closeting. And in March of 2022, Ron DeSantis passed the Parental Rights in Education Bill, better known as the Don't Say Gay Bill, which prohibits classrooms instruction related to LGBTQ issues. And then he banned AP African American Studies. And do people remember the justification he gave for banning it? He said, quote, "This course on Black history, what's one of the lessons about? Queer theory. Now, who would say that that is an important part of Black history? Is somebody pushing an agenda on our, that is somebody pushing an agenda on our kids, right? Who would say that queer theory is an important part of Black history? Lorraine Hansberry, James Baldwin, Pauli Murray, Audre Lorde, Ma Rainey, Bessie Smith, Bayard Rustin, Marsha P. Johnson. I mean, we could go on and on and on. You cannot understand the Black experience and the Black rebellion without understanding it intersectionally with queer and women's history. And educational closeting was just intensified in this country on June 27th when the Supreme Court handed down a chilling 6-3 decision in Muhammad versus Taylor, siding with a group of parents in Maryland who demanded that public schools allow them to opt their children out of any lesson containing LGBTQ plus characters or themes. And Chase Strangio for the UCLA explained it like this, quote, "What's chilling about this case from the 6-3 majority is the way in which they talk about LGBTQ people. They cast these books as coercive simply because they have LGBT characters. We should follow also this court that has continually cast LGBTQ people as a viewpoint and as an ideology, not as a community that exists." We should know this isn't the first time that queer people have come under severe attack in the education system. During the late 40s and early 50s, the McCarthyist Red Scare drove thousands of teachers out of the profession. Over 400 teachers in New York City alone were fired under suspicion of being communist. But what is less studied is the overlapping Lavender Scare that occurred at the same time, and actually more federal employees were fired under suspicion of being homosexual than they were of being members of the Communist Party. And in Florida, they enacted what was called the Johns Committee. And this committee first was started to attack any kind of racial justice movements, especially educators who were teaching about racial justice or the Black freedom struggle. Any teacher who had affiliation with the NAACP was attacked by the Johns Committee, but it quickly turned its mission into fighting against LGBTQ plus educators, and especially single women were brought before the Johns Committee and had their sex lives interrogated. Hundreds were fired under suspicion of being lesbians. This is the playbook that the current uncritical race theorists and educational closeters are drawing from. And they have three major goals, I believe, with this attack on education. And I want to outline the three major goals they have, because I think that most of the discussion in the mainstream today is limited to only the first goal I'm going to lay out here, but it goes much deeper than that. The first goal is to attack public education, to attack anti-racist education in order to win elections, right? And we saw the way in the 2022 midterms and in the most recent presidential election, they instilled fear in white families that schools were designed to shame their white children and that they should vote for the GOP because they were going to protect your white family from these attacks, right? And so they were used successfully to drive white families to the polls to vote for Republican candidates. But when you read about it in the mainstream media, that's the only reason that's given for why they are attacking anti-racist education. And it's much deeper than that, because the next level of it is the drive for privatization. They have been trying to figure out for a long time how to privatize the public school system. You know, the libraries and the public schools are some of the last institutions we have that are free and open to the public, and they want to profit off of that. This is capitalism. You can't just be giving things away. I mean, it's our labor that's paying for the taxes that is paying for the schools, but in their minds, it's just giving it away. And so if you can convince families that their children are being shamed by social justice, anti-racist teachers, you can drive them out of the public schools and convince them to move to charters or use voucher school programs and begin to dismantle the public schools. And we know that the language of school choice that's used with charter schools and voucher schools came from the massive resistance movement against integrating schools. It came from the segregationists opposing Brown versus Board of Education. So this is definitely one of the main strategies they have for privatizing the public schools. But that's not the end of it. That is definitely a major goal. But I want us to look deeper than that and to understand the long history of the attack on black education, on anti-racist education, on indigenous education. Because they've always known that they have to destroy entire systems of knowledge, especially those rooted in history and wisdom of oppressed people. They can't maintain a system this unequal if people understand where that inequality came from, where the wealth in society is produced, and who is profiting off of that and who is not. And so they want to impose epistemicide, right? The murder of ways of knowing, the murder of knowledge, as a way to maintain their power. And that became a crucial political strategy in the wake of the 2020 uprising. Racists got scared, y'all. I mean, you need to understand that that was the most number of people protesting in U.S. history. The New York Times said over 20 million people marched in every single state in the country demanding radical reform. I would argue that the biggest place that the 2020 uprising had concrete policy impacts was in education. And we won ethnic studies programs and black studies programs, and every New York Times bestseller book was an anti-racist title, and this freaked uncritical race theorists out. And they knew that it was time to be more forceful in the quest for epistemicide. Usually they're content with the hidden curriculum. Usually they're content with erasing our stories out of the corporate textbooks and then mandating we teach from these and then hiding our history that way. But when this mass rebellion revealed the truth about this country and people started learning about the Tulsa massacre and the true history of this country, they had to revert to more overt attacks. And That's when billionaires felt threatened and got involved. And I write about that in the chapter called The Political Economy of Truth Crime. And in the mainstream telling of this attack on anti-racist education, they say that, well, during COVID, families got to see what their children were learning on Zoom, and they were horrified by the shaming of their children, and a grassroots movement was born to defend education. The piece they left out there was white families. They don't usually like to use the descriptor there. And then the other piece they left out was a very small minority of white families who were funded by billionaires, not quite your vision of grassroots. So we can talk about Julie Fancelli, who is the Publix grocer fortune head and financed the January 6th uprising, who spent tens of thousands of dollars to organizations promoting book bans. Or we can talk about Betsy DeVos, former education secretary, Amway billionaire, who is financing laws to ban anti-racist teaching, or Charles Koch, or Bear Said, who gave $1.6 billion to right-wing activist Leonard Leo, who used the funds to shape policy through organizations like the Free to Learn Coalition, the misnamed Free to Learn Coalition that was active in Virginia's 2021 election.
You're listening to Jesse Hagopian on the War on Education. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or go online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
And yes, it's true that most K-12 educators never studied critical race theory, but there's so much overlap with what social justice teachers do teach that when liberals only response to like Moms for Liberty and all these groups, liberals would just say, well, we're not teaching critical race theory. And you heard that from so many Democratic Party politicians. Right? That was their response to all these laws banning Black history, banning LGBTQ plus identity. We're not teaching critical race theory. But what about the question of should we be? Right? They didn't want to touch that because they're funded by the same billionaires who are uncomfortable with young people learning the origins of this country. And so people like Natalie Wexler, a senior contributor to Forbes and a liberal uncritical race theorist, she wrote this: if Democrats want to win elections and allow kids to get a meaningful education, they should stop dismissing parents' complaints about critical race theory as nonsensical fabrications. It would make sense to avoid teaching concepts like white privilege. So in other words, let's lie to kids about race. And how did that work out for the Democrats? Okay, well, they are morally bankrupt because they didn't stand up to fight for anti-racist education, and they lost the House and the Senate and the White House. The refusal to defend honest education about race has demoralized large swaths of the Democratic Party's base, and the evidence is just everywhere. And you know, Diane Ravitch wrote something really interesting, too, about what was going on with billionaires and the Democratic Party around these truth crime laws. And she wrote this, quote, "The most puzzling aspect of this coordinated effort to suppress the teaching of accurate history is the silence of people who should have spoken up to defend the schools and their teachers. The most prominent no-shows on the ramparts is Secretary of Education Miguel Cardona under Biden, right? And then she writes, where was Bill Gates? Although right-wing wingnuts attacked Bill Gates for spreading CRT, Gates said nothing to defend the schools and teachers. He is not known for his shyness. Why the silence about teaching the nation's history with adherence to the truth, right? A guy who spent his entire life here using billions to rank and sort our children with high-stakes standardized tests and impose standardization, who's in every education debate for the last few decades, all of a sudden is absent and has nothing to say. And I think to understand what's going on with the shift and this massive attack on anti-racist education, on the public schools in general, we have to understand the groundbreaking 1976 book called Schooling in Capitalist America, written by economists Samuel Bowles and Herbert Gintis, that argued that the structure of education has a direct relationship to the structure of the economy. And they called this the correspondence principle. And the basic idea is that schools are not neutral. They don't just prepare students for life in a general sense. They prepare students to fit into the existing social and economic order. And schools are shaped to reflect and reproduce the needs of the dominant economic system. And so there are many historical examples of how this works, right? We can look at the early 20th century, how industrial capitalism demanded punctual, obedient factory labor. And so schools responded with rigid schedules and rote memorization, authoritarian discipline, vocational tracking, especially for working class students and students of color. Or we can look at the post-war era, you know, the Cold War competition that drove the expansion of STEM education, not to cultivate curiosity or critical thinking, but to produce technocrats, weapon developers, space race engineers to help the U.S. compete with the Soviet Union. And so the idea is that when there are major changes in the economy, the education system also is transformed to reflect those changes, to prepare the next generation of workers for that new economy. And so what's going on in our economy right now that is forcing a change in the way our education system is constructed? There's a lot of things, but for time, I want to hit on a couple of them. And one, I think, is just as factories once shaped the structure of schools, I think algorithmic capitalism is now reshaping it through AI and automation. In April, the Secretary of Education, Linda McMahon, she was at a major ed tech conference, maybe you saw this in San Diego, and she declared that students across the U.S. would soon benefit from A1 teaching. She said it over and over again, A1 teaching. The moment went viral. Late night hosts roasted her, and A1 steak sauce posted a mock ad that said, "You heard her, every school should have access to A1. It was funny until it wasn't, because behind this gaffe, she was arguing for something very disturbing, right? That we should replace the emotional and intellectual process of teaching and learning with the mechanical process of content delivery, data extraction, and surveillance of artificial intelligence. Bill Gates, in a recent interview, said the AI will get to that ability to be as good as any tutor, as any human ever could. AI will replace doctors and teachers within 10 years. That's their vision for education, one where teachers are replaced by chatbots. And in this system, the goal isn't to liberate students, it's to train them to adapt to machines rather than to question who programs those machines and why. And so we're seeing that change in our schools right now. But I also want to point you to an article by Naomi Klein and Astrid Taylor that was published in The Guardian called End Times Fascism. And they talk about how the climate crisis, the rise of AI, nuclear warfare, and other overlapping crises are leading to what they call end times fascism, right? And billionaires are preparing for end times fascism, not by trying to solve the climate crisis or regulate AI, but by building bunkers, luxury bunkers in New Zealand, and colonizing space. That's why Elon Musk wants to flee to Mars. Right? Good riddance. So in this era of overlapping crises, I would argue that they are trying to reconfigure the education system to instill hopelessness and surrender. All of this means that capitalism is facing a lengthy crisis, and the solution is not to resolve these problems, but to normalize them through education. Schools increasingly operate as sites of emotional management, training young people not to challenge systemic injustice, but to cope with it. And so curriculum focuses on resilience and grit, what they call grit, rather than resistance. And so trauma-informed practices are divorced from any analysis of structural violence. And students are told to recycle, to be kind, to be hopeful, but not to question the fossil fuel industry or imperialist wars or political collapse or economic collapse. Black, indigenous, and Palestinian histories are banned from the classroom. And this is what I call Armageddon academics, a pedagogy that teaches students to accept catastrophe as inevitable and even deserved while suppressing the collective memory of rebellion. And if schools once trained working class children to endure the factory, now they are training students to prepare for the end of the world, to just instill the hopelessness that nothing can be done. And that's why I think that socialists should prioritize the fight for education. It doesn't have to be this way. We've seen proof, and especially in the 2020 uprising, when young people took the lead. At the same time, we were talking about this education gap, that they were hopeless, kids were hopelessly falling behind because they weren't in the classroom. Young people were in the streets teaching the world about systemic racism. And we need to, as a left, as socialists, understand that education is not a side issue. They cannot achieve their fascist goals without capturing the schools and transforming them into sites of hopelessness. And they know that, and that's why they've spent so many billions of dollars to try to transform the curriculum. But our side hasn't woken up to that yet. The left and socialists have not made education one of the centerpieces of our fight, right? And when we do, when we make education the focus of the fight for socialism, what you can do is bring in all the other fights, because you can't fight for education without fighting for immigrant rights, because our children are being snatched out of school by fascist ICE agents. You can't fight for education, right, without fighting for queer students and trans students, because they are criminalizing their existence in schools and kicking them off of their sports teams and not letting them use the bathroom. And so education brings together all these different issues that can galvanize the left. And I think that we need to understand the strategic importance of fighting around education. Education is the most unionized workforce of any workforce in the country. If we are going to survive this climate collapse and the rise of fascism, if humanity has a future left on this planet, it's going to be because the labor movement figured out how to fight. Without a mass fighting labor movement that can shut down the capitalist system and show working people that actually we have the power, actually it's our labor that makes this system run, then we're done with this experiment of humanity. And so if we're going to pick a place to fight, let's start where the place with the most unionized workers that have shown they're willing to fight over and over again. I just want to end with the Teach Truth movement that is growing up around this country and refusing to back down to the uncritical race theorists, because in the beginning of June, we held our fifth annual Teach Truth Week of Action, spearheaded by the Zen Education Project, which is organized by Teaching for Change and by Rethinking Schools. And from Alaska to Puerto Rico, from Hawaii all the way to Barcelona, Spain, over 200 events happened in communities all over. And these events were not just your ordinary rallies. Sometimes they were rallies, but oftentimes they were historical walking tours where educators showed people where the Black freedom struggle had occurred in their own community and showed them what would happen if these truth crime laws were passed in their own jurisdiction, that the history of their community could no longer be taught, right? There were reading flash mobs that were organized. There were banned book swaps and historical mini lessons on the fight for Black education. And they were held in parks and museums and classrooms and in libraries. And this is the real grassroots movement, right? Of parents and caregivers and students and educators coming together to refuse the imposition of these truth crime laws. And I want to suggest that we combat these truth crime laws. We combat what Professor Henry Giroux called the violence of organized forgetting with what I write about in the book, The Healing of Organized Remembering. And the radical healing of organized remembering identifies collective efforts in education, but also in social movements, to uncover purposefully concealed historical lessons that are vital for recovering from historical trauma and for building healthy social movements for justice. And I don't have time to explain everything I mean about the healing of organized remembering, but I want to give you one example of what it can look like. Because I started teaching at my alma mater at Garfield High School in Seattle a little over a decade ago. And my first class I was assigned to was to teach AP US History. And you know, they wanted me to teach to the test, and that's not really my gig. And so I went to the Zen Education Project, and I was actually hired a couple months into the school year, so I had no time to prepare. I didn't even know what class I was teaching the first day I got into the room. So I had to scramble to find lessons. So I went to the Zen Education Project and just started going through everything they had to teach US history. And you know, so I taught lessons like the one on abolition, where the students all become different members of different abolitionist organizations, and they have to debate the strategies for how to overthrow slavery. And then they compare what they came up with to what the actual abolitionist organizations did. We did the same for the women's suffrage movement. We did the same for the civil rights movement. They all become members of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and they have to debate, should we allow white college students to join SNCC? Will they be effective in reaching rural Mississippi sharecroppers who we want to organize into the fight, right? Should we prioritize the fight to register people to vote, or should we prioritize the fight for direct action and sit-ins? So they take the actual debates, and then they debate it through and then compare what the real SNCC decided to do, right? We did that for the Vietnam War and so many other issues. And at the end of the school year, you know, a lot of them ended up doing very well on the AP exam, even though we hadn't properly prepared for it, because they loved history and they wanted to actually study it. But I told them that that's not actually when they passed my test. It was the following year when the state legislature announced that they were going to cut billions of dollars from the education budget in Washington state. This was in the wake of the Great Recession, when hundreds of teachers were laid off across Washington state and thousands across the country. And our state constitution in Washington declares that education is the, quote, paramount duty of the state. And it was clarified by the courts that that meant that the state had to spend over half of the budget on education. And they'd been in violation of that law for many years. So many of us in our radical social justice union caucus, we believed it wasn't just immoral that they were cutting billions from education. We believed it was illegal. And so we went down to the session where they were getting ready to cut those billions of dollars, and we were able to get into the House Ways and Means Committee meeting where they gaveled in the session to cut the billions, and we mic checked the room and we read out the state constitution. We declared that we were at the scene of a crime, not just any crime, the highest crime. You're violating the highest law of our state. Well, you might not be surprised to hear that the police officer in the room did not have the same interpretation of the law that I did, and he ended up arresting me instead of the state legislature, especially when I pulled out a pair of plastic handcuffs and invited them into my custody for a citizen's arrest. They did not appreciate that. So I spent the evening in jail, and when I got out, I went to Garfield High School the next day, and a kid came running up to me before I got into the building, and he said, "Mr. Hagopian, it worked." I said, "What?" He said, "Well, I started a Facebook page called Free Mr. Hagopian, and here you are." Thanks for getting me out, man. This was one of my students that went through that class the year before, right? Who had learned the history of social movements. And then you know what he did next that was magical? He turned that Facebook page into a page that said, "Walk out against the budget cuts." And the very next day, in 24 hours, they organized a mass walkout of over 500 students that marched down to City Hall. They had flyers, they had banners. It was just incredible. Demanded an audience with the mayor. They got their picture in the New York Times. They wrote an op-ed for the Seattle Times. They organized a citywide walkout. They started an organization. They put pressure on the state legislature and on the state Supreme Court. And within just a couple of months, the state Supreme Court ruled in our favor that it was in fact in violation of the law, and they were forced to add billions more dollars to the education budget. Just a resounding victory. That is what uncritical race theorists really fear. They know we're not shaming white children in these classes. They know we're teaching white children about John Brown, about Anne Braden, about the Grimke sisters, about Howard Zinn. We're teaching them about multiracial social justice movements. And that's what they fear. They fear that our kids are going to learn those lessons and then go out and apply them in the real world. And that's what I mean by the healing of organized remembering. And so I'll just end with an idea about what we're fighting for, because we have immense challenges in our world today. But we have a key advantage that has led to incredible victories for justice throughout history, and that is that they are very few and we are many. The richest 1% use their wealth to manipulate the education system, but the good news is they are only 1%. But they're only 1% if we overcome the divisions of racism and homophobia and transphobia and xenophobia. Otherwise, we're all 1% in our own little enclaves. And so that's why education is central to the fight for socialism. We have to teach people the history of multiracial struggles. We have to teach people how they invented race consciously to divide and conquer working people if we hope to win. And because the classroom isn't just a place of instruction, it's a place of possibility where the next generation can begin to learn not just how the world is, but how to transform it. There have been many names given to the destination of those seeking relief from racism and oppression, and I want to just end with reading a passage from the conclusion of my book about what the goal of our destination is. The poet Phyllis Wheatley, who had been enslaved and kidnapped from West Africa before gaining her freedom, and becoming the first African-American author to publish a book of poetry called The Destination, Deliverance. She wrote, quote, "In every human breast, God has implanted a principle which I call love of freedom. It is impatient of oppression, and it pants for deliverance." The great gospel soul band, the Staple Singer, called our destination simply a place in their hit single, I'll Take You There. And they told us that in this place, no one would be smiling at us while they lied to our face. You know that song, I'll Take You There? Martin Luther King called our destination the beloved community. He wrote, quote, "The end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of a beloved community." The Black Panther Party called it socialism. As member Assata Shakur put it, capitalism meant that the rich businessmen owned all the wealth, while socialism meant that the people who made the wealth owned it. Stevie Wonder called our destination higher ground, and he invited us in his sonically soaring refrain to keep on going until we reach it. And this higher ground is not an isthmus with only room for a few. There is room for everyone, and you're all invited to join us there. Thank you.
You were just listening to Jesse Hagopian on the war on education. He spoke at the Socialism 2025 conference in Chicago in July. Jesse Hagopian is a Seattle-based educator who has taught in public schools for over 20 years. He's the author of Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, an independent nonprofit in our 40th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Winona LaDuke, Claudia De La Cruz, Arundhati Roy, Gabor Mate, Chris Hedges, and Tariq Ali. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting for free, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Jesse Hagopian on the War on Education, and for Jesse Hagopian's book, Teach Truth, The Struggle for Anti-Racist Education, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us 1-800-444-1977. Joe Ritchie is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening.
Forbes Avenue is a production of WRCT Pittsburgh. The opinions expressed are those of the participants and not necessarily those of WRCT, its members, or Carnegie Mellon University. Email questions or comments to pa@wrct.org.
You're listening to Forbes Avenue on WRCT Pittsburgh, 88.3 FM. I'm your host, Archan Das, and today we're here with...
Erica Hyde. I'm a senior park ranger for the city of Pittsburgh. I work out of the Department of Public Safety.
And we're here to learn a little bit more about the deer management program in the city of Pittsburgh. Thanks for coming on the show.
Of course.
So tell us a little bit more. What is the deer management program?
Yeah, so the deer management program is an effort to control the overpopulation of white-tailed deer in the city of Pittsburgh limits, specifically looking into our parks, which will then result in benefits for our local residents around parks and throughout the city as a whole. So We were approached by a group of citizens within a neighborhood organization, primarily within the Friends of Riverview Park, which is up in the north side of Pittsburgh. And that was also joined by the Squirrel Hill Urban Coalition. And they kind of merged together and formed a group of concerned citizens, specifically between their two organizations, but also citywide, that were complaining about the effects of deer, primarily across the city, eating their vegetation, potentially being in vehicle collisions with deer. And they wanted to take that effort and that interest and formulate it into a deer management program. So when we met with them, we were basically just the people to help get that legislation through and also formulate a deer management program that was effective, but primarily safe for all of our park goers and citizens visiting the city of Pittsburgh. So,
sure. Within the deer management program, I think when most people think about a word like deer management, you're thinking about what seems like sort of science-y methods, sterilizing deer and such. Mm-hmm. But the deer management program in Pittsburgh actually involves hunting. Can you talk a little bit more about why that choice was made?
We evaluated both non-lethal and lethal methods for deer management as a whole. So we very early on looped in the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, to help us through this process. They are experts in it. They've been running deer management programs for way longer than we have. We also looked at other parks around us that match kind of our, you know, demographic and our acreage and whatnot. So we really like Cincinnati's model, and we basically took Cincinnati's model, worked with the USDA, made a couple tweaks here and there, and we came up with our solution. So right now in Pennsylvania, you cannot legally do any sort of non-lethal deer management. It's primarily, the big thing is it's not going to help handle the deer population that we have as of today. We are already overabundant. If we put in non-lethal methods, one, they're not going to be.
You're listening to WRCT, Pittsburgh.